It is Sunday, July 14th, and this is episode 26 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As usual, the thoughts and opinions I express on this podcast are mine and do not represent those of my employer. Well, I have a good bit of news for you this afternoon, so let's go ahead and get started. First up is a very interesting article in the New York Times about the marketplace for vulnerabilities. Not really something you would expect to typically see in the New York Times, mind you. I think it's a fairly revealing piece, probably more so for those people who aren't really familiar with the concept. But there were two interesting things that stood out for me. The first is that buried in the article is a comment about a zero-day for iOS being sold for $500,000. And by iOS, I mean the operating system that runs on your iPhone, not the one that runs on your Cisco router. Unfortunately, there really isn't any context to that angle of the story. So maybe it's patched, maybe it's still active, who really knows? The other angle, which isn't really clearly spelled out, but has got me thinking after reading the article, is whether or not the big debacle going on with Edward Snowden and all of the crap that he is leaking is actually going to really drive this vulnerability market. And by that I mean, we now have a situation where everybody knows what's going on with the U.S. and actually even some other governments like Germany and France and the U.K. and Australia as well. And I have to wonder if those governments who maybe have been sitting off on the sidelines are now taking what they're seeing as an incentive to go off and start their own program or make their program a little more aggressive and basically increase considerably the demand and obviously the price that could be paid for these vulnerabilities, which I think could end up being a bit problematic because now it's potentially far more lucrative to sell your exploits in a marketplace that's primarily dominated by governments across the world, as opposed to, for instance, following the normal course of disclosure to vendors, and we're seeing this bug bounty type program really becoming very popular. And I wonder if, and that may end up eating into the success of those bug bounty programs, which I think is a net negative for most everybody. And speaking of bug bounty programs, there's two interesting developments on that front. Number one, Microsoft has thrown their head in the ring and they are now developing their own bug bounty program. And the other was a study done that discovered that bug bounty programs are between 2 and 10 times more economical to run than hiring your own in-house QA / security team specifically to find security flaws. I think the problem with that is that it likely doesn't scale down very well. So if you're a small shop, I suspect it's going to be really difficult to, number one, come up with the kind of money that's going to incent people to pay attention to your products, and two, just have mindshare enough for people to be interested and aware of the opportunity to work with you. Okay, the next story I can essentially sum up by saying that the OWASP Top 10 is still relevant. The SIDN, which is the registrar in the Netherlands, apparently had an SQLi, or SQL injection vulnerability, on their website. So as of this time, I'm not aware of anything malicious that was done with it. However, it caused a bit of a flap because SIDN froze the zone files for the .nl domains, at least for a period of time while they were investigating. SQLi seems like one of those things that should just be relegated to history, yet it keeps popping up. And I suspect part of it's because there's new tools, part of it's because we have a constant new crop of people writing web applications that hadn't done so before. And probably also that the applications themselves are becoming ever more complicated. The good news is, with the right planning and tools and training, this is a pretty easy thing to avoid. And it's really something that we ought to be working very closely with our developers to make sure they understand the importance of not only SQLi, but all of the OWASP Top 10. I mean, these are all problems that happen very frequently. They're common mistakes, and they are commonly exploited. All right, the next two stories have a common theme, and that theme is default passwords. So, HP has two different storage lines. So these are storage devices, SAN devices, and they have a built-in support account. So when someone who owns one of these devices has a problem, they can call up HP, and HP support staff can connect to it and get on and fix their problem. The challenge is that it's a static password for every device. And as far as I can tell, it doesn't allow the owner to actually change that password. So basically, this is an undocumented account that users aren't able to disable. So one of the pieces of equipment has already been patched, and the other is being patched, I believe, on July 17th. Not a great thing, to be sure. The next story, which is related, is the EAS, or Emergency Alert System, here in the United States. There's a equipment manufacturer named Monroe Electronics who makes some servers that allow the injection of emergency alerts into the, basically, the TV signal that is being emitted by TV networks. So that server has a root account set up with a static SSH key. And as you might imagine, it's the same SSH key across all of the different devices. So if you happen to know where one of these systems are, you're pretty much able to log in and do whatever you want. And there's one more slightly related story, and that is a bug in IPMI. IPMI is a standard protocol to interface with the motherboard of servers. So you can do things like reboot the server, check the temperature of the motherboard, basically look at diagnostics. You can also do more advanced things like mount media, which could potentially get into the boot order and funny things like that. So lots of opportunities to attack a system. Well, there's a lot of systems that have their IPMI ports exposed to the internet. I think H.D. Moore was quoted as saying he detected about 100,000 of them on the internet. Unfortunately, IPMI has a pretty easy way to bypass authentication or to send a specially crafted packet, which will then return the password hash, which you can go and brute force and then log in and have your way with the server. So all three of these stories have something in common. They're all pretty gross weaknesses in things that should not be exposed to the internet. So you should not have to worry about someone attaching to your HP SAN through the management interface who is not allowed, because you have good network controls. If you need HP to get into your network, you need to admit them somehow, and then they can get in. Otherwise, people don't get in. Same thing with the EAS. If you have a specific source for emergency alerts, you only allow that traffic to connect. IPMI is very, very similar. You should not have an IPMI interface sitting out on the internet. In all of those cases, those devices should be on some kind of a management network. Now, it's not a panacea, but this is back to the concept of defense in depth. I mean, this is like 1998 kind of thought process. We should have a healthy skepticism for those kinds of services. They shouldn't be intermingled with normal systems on the network. They really ought to be fenced off on their own dedicated segments. When I used to run IT for a company, we had a dedicated, what I think we called it, a tools segment. We basically had our KVM systems and management ports and those sorts of things on a very, very isolated network. And that's the kind of network where you need to be really doing pretty aggressive monitoring of who's talking. You need to have some pretty strong alerting so that if you see an IP address talking to one of the systems on that network that hasn't ever talked before, it should be triggering some blinky light that somebody ought to go investigate. Because whether or not IPMI is known to be vulnerable or EAS has a known SSH key or HP has a static password, people shouldn't be able to get to those services anyway. And these are not things that are expensive to set up. Most switching architectures now let you set up VLANs, which will allow you to fence off things pretty well and really not incur additional costs. Maybe you need to burn a port on a firewall, but in the scheme of things, it really isn't a big investment for the risk that you're covering. So just to recap, HP storage servers, static password, they're vulnerable. One of the devices is patched, the other patch will be coming out soon. Even if you log in, it appears the worst you can do is delete data. Possibly you could maybe make the data available to a server who wouldn't otherwise have that access. But, you know, you're not going to be copying data off of it. It's probably more of an availability kind of attack. IPMI, that's going to be vulnerable for a long time. There's, as I understand it, some really structural weaknesses in the protocol, and so there's going to have to be some pretty significant rework done, and some of it's going to be, I believe, at the standard level, so the IPMI standard, but then also the actual machine makers are going to have to release patches to address the problem. And then the EAS boxes from Monroe, apparently there is a patch out there, and they are claiming that most of their customers have installed the patch. But please, please, please make sure that you think about how you architect your network and what services you expose to what populations. Okay, the next story is a follow-up from March. This was an attack on South Korea, which has become known as the Dark Seoul attack. And I mean Seoul as in Seoul, South Korea. McAfee released a very, very long report. I think it's 33 pages, something like that. It's a pretty long report that goes into detail about their findings. And the sum of it is that what we saw in March was just one component of a four-year-long, very thorough and persistent attack on South Korea that did include a lot of espionage activities. And so they go through a pretty thorough analysis showing that there were data stealing Trojans from years back that share the same code base as the tools that were deployed to wipe the malware. Now, there's still some questions in my mind about how this attack worked. In McAfee's write-up, they claim that the boot record wiper was deployed on the day that it wiped. So they're claiming that there was a compromise of a update system that pushed out an update, and that infected lots of systems inside the organization, and they all triggered roughly at the same time. Where that breaks down for me, and really didn't seem to be addressed in the article, is that my recollection was it wasn't just one organization that was attacked. It was a number of media outlets and a number of banks. And that leaves me wondering, how can the compromise of a software update server compromise lots of PCs across multiple organizations? And I don't have a satisfactory answer to that, other than possibly they were all using the same kind of software update system, and therefore they potentially spearfished the right people at each of these organizations and then compromised the update server. It's not really clear to me how that happened. But I definitely get the sense from having read the article that this really was essentially some economic sabotage, and probably, dare I say it, an example of cyber war from one country against another. And the intention being to disrupt the media and to disrupt commerce by shutting down banks and making ATMs unavailable and whatnot. So quite possibly it was an attempt to figure out how the concept would work, what the response would be, and how fast they would be back up and running. So potentially probing defenses to understand what the reaction will be. So the report doesn't actually say who perpetrated the attack. They name a couple of different groups, but then they essentially say that it's quite likely that the groups are a fabrication anyhow. And there is one interesting thing I gleaned from it, and that is, if I ever turned into a bad guy and started writing malware, I would change the system date on my computer all the time, because my goodness, the McAfee people seem to put a lot of stock in the compile dates on the binaries. And I could easily see how you could create some chaos by tweaking your date as you compile your malware, The other thing is there's a lot of stock put in the compile paths. And so if I, again, were a bad person, I probably would think about taking a look at some other malware out there and figuring out what kinds of compile paths were in it and set up my build environment to look like that. If nothing else, it will temporarily possibly throw off people who were searching for me. But, you know, then I realize I'm not actually all that smart of a guy. And so that makes me wonder how many other people who maybe are smart and evil have thought about this already. All right, moving on. This next story is really sad, and it actually hurts my heart to read this story. And I would call this story doing incident response horribly wrong. So the story goes, back in 2011, in December, this U.S. government department called the Economic Development Administration was notified by what I would characterize as their data center provider or their network provider, which is another government entity. Anyway, they were notified by an emergency response team in another part of the government that about 146 of their systems on the network were exhibiting evidence of malware or being infected with malware. And the EAD or EDA freaked out. They completely freaked out. And what ensued was just total chaos. So the incident handler at the group that notified EDA apparently was not very experienced. And so rather than actually looking at what was infected or showing signs of being infected, that person apparently pulled a report of all of EDA's assets and provided that in a report. And at some point the next day, apparently, the incident response team apparently realized their mistake and they sent an updated notice. But apparently the updated notice made it worse, basically saying that the previous version, previous report was accurate. And anyway, they were trying to convey that the previous report was inaccurate and that only two systems were exhibiting behavior of being infected. The problem was that EDA apparently was really lax with security and they were not on top of their game. And so basically everybody kind of thought that, you know, hey, they probably are totally owned. And so nobody really had a problem thinking that they were. And they had recently gotten a new CIO in this EDA department who was fairly critical of the security capability of his team and became thoroughly convinced that his entire IT infrastructure had been compromised and was being used for reconnaissance by some nation-state actor. So they hired a cybersecurity contractor to come in and look at their environment. The contractor apparently found evidence that their environment was totally owned. However, after a little more analysis, it was all false positives, and what they actually found were some very garden variety pieces of malware on a limited number of systems and no evidence of anything advanced. However, the CIO apparently, now I'm going to speculate here as someone who works in the world of forensics. You are not supposed to speculate, but you know what? I'm going to speculate and say the CIO was relatively inexperienced. And he asked the cybersecurity contractor to give an assurance that his environment was not compromised with advanced malware. And, well, you can't give that kind of assurance. And so he didn't get the assurance. And basically what happened was the CIO decided that he was totally owned and the only way out was to destroy physically all of their IT equipment and start over from the ground up. So after destroying about $170,000 worth of TVs, monitors, keyboards, mice, PCs, and what have you, apparently they ran out of money. I know that seems shocking. So at some point, an independent auditor came in, another government agency came in, and essentially found that none of this was real. It was all a big misunderstanding between different government agencies who didn't understand what one was communicating. There was some inexperienced people on both sides of the house. So on the incident response team, they had some inexperienced people. Obviously, on the EDA side, they had some inexperienced people. And they just kept feeding on each other. And EDA would produce a report, which would claim that they were completely owned. That would get circulated and taken as gospel. When the EDA people would go talk to them, those people would reference the report that came from EDA, and EDA would take that as further evidence that they were actually right, when in fact they were just parroting back what EDA had told them already. So total disaster all around. And I think this is a really important report for you to read. I included a link not only to the article, but also to the audit report, which is a relatively quick read. It's over a 30-page PDF file, but it is absolutely worth reading. And it really definitely shows how important it is to have people who deeply understand incident response involved in your security incidents, because otherwise people will make very wild speculations and will often be completely off the mark. Now, clearly it pays to be conservative and be suspicious and whatnot, but you know, there is a threshold beyond which you're just wasting money and your ignorance is compounding the problem. And so it's really, really important to have some strong bench strength in the incident management function, which can provide guidance and some sanity. So for instance, when you see a virus scan of a file server show up lots of hits, you might think that, oh, hey, there's people who have in their email archive some garden variety viruses, and that's what we're seeing, rather than seeing that report and thinking, oh my goodness, the server is infected with thousands of different kinds of malware. Those are very, very different statements. So in the end, they wasted, I think, $2.7 million, which apparently was about half of their IT budget for the year 2012. And that money was spent essentially chasing a ghost. I also don't think it included any labor slowdowns for the workers in that department while their IT infrastructure was unavailable. So again, I definitely strongly advise you to read the report. It is very well written, it's very thorough, and I think it will help put into context some challenges that we all deal with and maybe have a benefit when we talk to some of the more senior management at our companies to help understand, you know, the implications behind doing incident response wrong. All right, the last story is about the DNS Calc gang, who apparently is another Chinese hacking group similar to Comment Crew, who allegedly went after U.S. organizations like the New York Times back in 2012. And in this story, they talk about how these attackers are using Dropbox and WordPress, and they're not compromising Dropbox or WordPress. They're using them in a, quote, legitimate fashion. What they're doing is signing up for both a WordPress.com account and a Dropbox account, and they're hosting what appear to be legitimate files on Dropbox, and then spear phishing out some emails to different groups who then are pointed to go to this Dropbox site and download what looks like an official report. And in fact, when you open it, it actually is an official report, but it comes with some extra tools, specifically a screensaver, and obviously it also drop some malware on, which checks a WordPress account and obtains the address of a command and control system, and the malware then reaches out to the command and control and then does what it wants to do, downloads more malware, starts exfiltrating data, all of the normal fun stuff. So while that's all really interesting, I think the important thing to me is that they're relying on the reputation of Dropbox. So for many organizations, Dropbox is permitted and you can access files on that site through the firewall and web filters and whatnot. But also, because a lot of people are becoming more comfortable with using it, they'll see a file hosted on a Dropbox with a somewhat legitimate looking name, and it puts them at ease. They're not so worried, even though they have no idea who actually posted it. There's some implicit trust that's being breached there. So I think from a security awareness standpoint, this is really an opportunity to start educating people on how some of these attacks are being perpetrated and leveraging trust they have for standard services like Dropbox. And you know, the other thing is that with WordPress, hosting some of the infection tactics on WordPress also tends to lower the ability for IT departments and security departments to actually recognize command and control traffic as malicious. So you're not seeing suddenly a bunch of people reach out to a questionable site. You're seeing lots of people reach out to, you know, the WordPress.com farm, which probably isn't an uncommon thing if some new popular blog post gets mailed around. You probably would see that kind of thing pretty frequently, and as well, it's often allowed through company firewalls and web filters. So more things to think about. Well, it is way past my bedtime. It is now 2:30 a.m. and I'm getting pretty tired, so I'm gonna call it a night. And I definitely have enjoyed talking to you all again today, and I hope you all have a great week. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter at DefensiveSec is the podcast, at MaliciousLink is my personal Twitter account. You can find the website at www.defensivesecurity.org. You can send me an email at info@defensivesecurity.org. I have to tell you, I would encourage you to go to the website, defensivesecurity.org, and go to the resources and take a look at the forensics section. I found some really cool forensic blogs posted by some really brilliant people. There's one in particular. I think it's called Windows Incident Response, or windowsir.blogspot.com, I believe is the URL. And it really is a phenomenal site. I definitely would encourage you to read it if you are at all interested in that kind of thing. Lots and lots of information, lots of tools and how-tos and whatnot. So cool stuff. Anyhow, have a great week, and I look forward to talking to you again next time. Take care. Bye.